Howdy, y'all. You're listening to The Managing Up Show, a podcast about leading and managing in the world of technology. I'm your host, Travis Weisgood, and with me this week are Brandon Hayes.
Hello.
And Nick Means.
Hey, everybody. So as we were trying to figure out what to record tonight, one of the things that popped to my mind, one of my personal heroes actually passed away yesterday, Captain Al Haynes. He was the pilot of United Flight 232 that crash landed in Sioux City, Iowa. It's a subject that I've studied a lot. I did a conference talk on it. And the reason Captain Haynes is one of my heroes is because of a specific style of leadership that he espoused, both in the accident and in the rest of his career. It's one of the things that's come up in literally every obituary I've read about him today, and that's the humility with which he carried himself. And I thought a nice way for me to honor Captain Haynes would be for us to do an episode and discuss a little bit about why humility in leadership is so important and what humility and leadership can bring to a team. So I kind of want to open it up just wide open right there, starting with that, and see where we go.
It sounds like a great topic to tackle. I'm curious for a little bit of background for those of us who aren't familiar with the story of what happened and why it was such an influential event.
Sure. So United 232 was a DC-10. It was flying from Denver to Chicago. Somewhere over the cornfields of Iowa, it lost the fan disc in its tail engine. And when that happened, it severed all three hydraulic systems in the plane, and the plane was essentially uncontrollable. But the crew had all been trained in the specific methodology called crew resource management. And it affected the way that they handled the scenario that unfolded before them. Specifically, it meant that Captain Haynes was looking to everyone on that airliner who could possibly be of assistance in the accident to try to find strategies to get the best outcome possible out of that situation. They managed to get the plane to the Sioux City Airport. They crash landed it there. And because they were able to crash land at a place where there were first responders available, 185 people survived. It's the first time anybody had ever survived a complete loss of control accident on a commercial airliner. And nobody was ever able to replicate their success in a simulator either. So the outcomes that they were able to get in the cockpit because of the leadership of Captain Haynes and the way that he brought the rest of the crew together were almost impossible to imagine.
So for a little additional context, I've seen the talk that you're referring to that you researched and gathered all this information, and you used it to tell a kind of a beat-by-beat, minute-by-minute story of the experience of what it was like on that plane. And it's literally the only conference talk I've sat my family down and had them watch. Of any kind, no, there's not a TED talk I think I've ever done that with. So to get to brag on my co-host a little bit, it's really an incredible talk. Anybody that hasn't seen it, it's one of the best, tech conference talks I think you're likely to see. And a lot of that has to do with the really interesting way that this crew decided to handle this unbelievably, literally life or death event. And there's an interesting question in there because you talk about the humility of this person, but also the system that they put in place was very different than what people sort of had used as a benchmark for how to handle crises like that in the past. So can you talk a little bit about what that crew resource management thing was that drove them to handle this crisis differently than you might otherwise?
If you think about the role of a captain, there's sort of this classical thing that pops to your mind, and he's the boss of the ship, be it on the ocean or be it in the air. And he's the one that's going to make all of the decisions. And one of the things that after studying several accidents that we learned was that that was not always the best idea, and that situations in which the captain was the only voice that spoke into the accident usually ended up with significantly worse outcomes than situations where the crew was able to work together more effectively. And so crew resource management was essentially training around how an air crew who may be seeing each other for the first time when they walk through the door of a cockpit for a particular flight can work together and make sure that if something comes up that someone needs to challenge the captain on or make sure the captain sees, that there's no power dynamic there that keeps that from happening. That traditional model of being a captain would normally entail. And the flip side of that is it's the captain's job in that cockpit to make sure that he or she is getting the input of everyone else in the cockpit and making sure that they are drawing that wisdom out of the other people that are there and not behaving in such a way that it's shutting them down and keeping them from sharing or bringing up critical safety information.
Yeah, I can see certainly how that happens. Like the crew of a ship dating back to 1400s, relies on the captain. You know, the captain is the steady. We have, I think every person that works in any kind of leadership carries around this sort of mental image that is iconic and also sort of endearing and nice to think about. A captain who is steady in choppy waters and calls all the shots and knows all the answers. And I'm curious to know, like, how did crew resource management come about? If, like, how did it come to supplant that idea that's, you know, ingrained in us for maybe thousands of years, that one person should be directing everybody else's movements in a crisis?
This is stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor of this talk. So I'm excited to actually get to do something with this research that's been piled up in my brain for years. The flight that's widely cited as the thing that brought crew resource management to popularity in aviation is United Flight 173. And this was a DC-8 that crashed right outside of Portland. And the reason it crashed is as they were coming in for their final approach and as they were lowering their landing gear, they were missing one of the confirmation lights that indicated their landing gear were down. And so they flew by the tower. The tower said it looks like it's down, but the indicator in the cockpit didn't show it as being locked into place. So this crew requested some time, and they went and circled over the ocean for a bit to try to diagnose this landing gear issue. And were coming back in towards PDX and still hadn't gotten confirmation that the gear were down. So they circled a little bit by the airport, and as this was happening, they were running lower and lower and lower on fuel. And so towards the end of this flight, both the first officer and the navigator were both calling out to the captain that they were about to run out of fuel and they needed to try to land, even though they didn't have this confirmation of gear down. And they ended up crashing about 3 miles short of PDX because the captain wouldn't listen. He was insistent on making one more go-round to try to diagnose this landing gear issue.
I think as a software developer, I can relate to, like, no, I've almost got it. I've almost got it. You know what? Just shut the laptop and walk away. Just 10 more minutes and it's 3 hours
just
later.
Just 10 more minutes.
You're watching your battery meter
It'll
drain.
Compile.
No, I've got this.
I've got this. I'm gonna fix this.
No, none of us.
I have no idea what you're talking
none
about.
None of us guilty. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amusing, the sort of hubris, but like human lives are actually at stake there.
Yeah, the other crash before that that's widely cited as another incident that led to CRM was the Tenerife disaster, which is still the deadliest air disaster of all time. It's when two 747s collided on the runway. And again, it was a situation where the first officer told the captain, "It sounds like that other plane hasn't cleared the runway." And the captain said, "Oh, no, it's fine." And they commenced the takeoff roll. And that killed nearly 600 people, I think.
Wow.
So yeah, human lives are absolutely at stake.
And I think that's probably why it got more attention and more science applied to it than in other areas, where the consequences of crappy leadership are, you know, lost profits and turnover and things that have such a long tail of catastrophe that you don't really know the effects of it until long after. You don't know that, you know, GE's culling the bottom 10% wasn't a great idea until their stock price tanks 15 years later or whatever, right? So a lot of times you get to skate on that stuff, whereas, you know, these consequences are moment to moment and very severe. And so it sounds like they went and applied a bunch of science to this and said, hey, it turns out when you're dealing in groups, other people have ideas besides just the captain. And so that changes the kind of person you want in a captain's chair, or certainly the type of behaviors you want to incentivize and reward.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, coming out of United 173, CRM became standard training for pilots in the U.S. It's mandated by the FAA now. So what that meant was at that point, they had a lot of legacy pilots that then had to learn how to manage a cockpit using this new set of techniques and skills.
So you had like a bunch of Captain Ron Burgundy's going, I don't know this newfangled collaboration thing.
Yeah, well, and the interesting thing is that Captain Haynes was 56 when Flight 232 happened. I think he was 56. He was in his 50s, I remember for sure. And so he had years in the cockpit as well.
But he was just like ready for it because he was like the type of person that wanted to solicit that feedback.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he saved a bunch of lives. How many, like literally the 180 people?
185, yeah, walked away.
So yeah, I looked at some of the articles on the internet today about him, and he has many people who feel like they owe their lives and their families to him that sort of honor him even now.
Yeah, the picture that ran in the Sioux City Journal, which Sioux City is where the plane crash happened, the picture that ran with the obituary today was of Captain Haynes with the granddaughter of one of the survivors of the crash.
Wow.
It's been interesting. This has impacted me more emotionally than I thought, kind of hearing of the loss of Captain Haynes, because he's really come to mean quite a lot to me as I've become a manager and I've learned more and more about the importance of the way that he led in the cockpit and have tried to apply those things to my career.
So if you were going to have to outline a few things that you've changed that you can draw a line to and say, I now do this or I now do that because of the knowledge I have of CRM and this particular crash and how it was handled, what would those be?
I mean, the biggest one is probably that I am almost never the person on the team who is best positioned to make a decision. There's almost always context that I'm going to be missing as a manager that someone who is actively working on the code face is going to have. And I can build that context. I can help facilitate conversations to break an impasse. But I don't need to be the one making decisions on a regular basis for the team because I don't have the full context. That's one of the biggest ones. And that's hard, right? Because it gets at how you actually control the output of a team. And it's not as a manager, it's not through making decisions. That's really akin to that classical model of being a captain where you're the one that has to make all the decisions.
Yeah, I'm the decider. Like, well, hold on there. You know, it does feel that way sometimes. You get put into a position where I think part of what I wanted to discuss about what puts humility in check a little bit and keeps it from coming to the fore is it doesn't always feel appropriate, because sometimes it feels like people are looking at you to captain the ship. People are looking at you to be the decider, to make the decisions. And here's a bunch of context. Look, if you'll just make a decision, we can move on. And I've seen a lot of job descriptions for managers and leaders that talk about decision-making ability, which I don't doubt. I know that's true that there's a lot of decisions, but I'm almost more interested in the decisions that you sort of reflect back to the team and say, well, I don't know, you're the expert. Here's all the context. Given the challenges that we're facing, what would you do? And not everybody can hold all that context in their head at one time, but these are not, you know, line workers on a factory that are there to turn one screw a prescribed number of times. This is a creative endeavor that involves lots of decision-making all the time.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about how crew resource management was rolled out into the aviation industry is that they didn't want to make the designation captain a worthless title. That was not something that they wanted to do. And so the captain is still the captain of the airplane. It is still his ship. It is still his responsibility. It's just the way that he interacts with the other people around him has changed. Mm-hmm. So as a manager, yeah, you still have responsibility for delivery. Yeah. That still falls on your shoulders. But the way that you should go about it is not necessarily by making all of the decisions. And there's certainly times when it is appropriate for you to make a decision or to help a team break an impasse. Or, you know, if the team is spiraling, sometimes you have to just break the tie and go on. But that's usually not the best strategy.
So we've been focusing a lot on the captain's role in this, and I would hazard a guess that a lot of our listeners are going to be in positions where they might be in that driver's seat and making those decisions, but also might be on teams where they're the ones helping support the decisions that are being made. If you find yourself in that kind of a situation, whether it's because you're an individual contributor or a manager reporting up to a director or whatever that position might be, what would your roles be in this CRM model?
Yeah, so half of CRM is training the captain to seek the input of everybody in the cockpit. The other half is training everybody in the cockpit to speak up, even if they're not in that left-hand seat. And I think that was, when I wrote the talk, I can't remember if I was in a management role or not at that point. If I was, it was just barely. So it was largely written from the perspective of the individual contributor on the team. And if you're the kind of person that tends to be quiet most of the time and not share your opinion, you need to speak up more. You need to give your team the value of your input and your opinion. And on the other hand, if you're the kind of person that is constantly speaking up in meetings, constantly dominating conversations, you need to check yourself a little bit and create an environment that's safe for everybody to have input in. And so that's really what it comes down to, is it's about balancing communication and making sure everybody has the opportunity to have input and that there aren't dominant voices.
So what are some practical takeaways for somebody who's listening to this and might recognize themselves as somebody who does tend to dominate a conversation or dominate a meeting? Sounds very aggressive, but recognizes that they tend to speak quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is if you recognize that you speak quite a bit, you probably need to learn to be a little bit more comfortable with space and silence in a conversation, because a lot of times it's unintentional and it's just filling gaps and filling dead air. So leaving a little bit more room for the people that need a second or two more to think before they share is one helpful way to go about it. Another is to make sure if there's somebody that you noticed hasn't spoken in a conversation, to ask them for their input, to call on them and encourage them to speak up.
Yeah, this is something I'm deeply afflicted with historically. This has been a difficult practice, actually, for me over the last 4 or 5 years to try to become a better active listener. And actually, a really great life hack before you learn active listening is you can just stop talking. And it really is difficult. I thought I was doing the world a favor by filling up all the empty space with what I presume to be like lubricant, conversational lubricant, like, hey, we're just keeping the flow going, baby. It's good. And it turns out that isn't great for everybody. That's not the best answer for people who will smile and nod through the hurricane of words, but they might have something really valuable to contribute, but they're not going out in there.
One of the best tips I got early on in my career, I took a group facilitation course, and one of the things they encouraged us to do when we were facilitating a group is to essentially time the silences, because those silences are way shorter than you think they are. And you feel like you need to jump in and fill that dead air at about 1 or 2 seconds of silence.
Yeah, there's a reason they call it dead air.
Yeah.
It feels like everyone in the room has died. It's weird.
So I don't know if this is actually true or not, or if this is just an urban legend, but I've heard here at KUT, at the local Austin NPR station, back when they used to have the music program, there was a certain morning DJ who they had to update their dead air alerts for. They had these alerts that would play if there was so many seconds of dead air broadcast, because they just assumed that something had gone wrong and they needed to alert the engineers so they could fix the feed. And he was notorious for just stopping. And he'd let a couple of seconds sit there and he'd be thinking, and it was just complete dead air while he was gathering his thoughts, and then he would jump right back in. Or I've heard it where he'd get up and walk around. You could hear him kind of shuffling around in the studio trying to find something while nothing is playing.
He's still on the air. He does the morning show on KUTX, and they have a bumper that they play that says, "That's not dead air. That's an eclecticos breeze." And there's these wind chimes that play in the background.
I love that. The reason that it feels so awful is because somebody feels like they're supposed to be on stage. A lot of times dead air is not okay because somebody's going to change the channel. Well, if you're in a conversation with somebody, you're trying to make sure that somebody's always on stage and always performing. Dead air is horrible. But that's not how conversations and drawing out feedback from people really works. It's about space. And creating space for people to come to you is a difficult task, and it requires letting that stuff kind of sit there. But the other aspect of it is it's actually not about you. And you have to go in with the mindset that it's about the question of what does everybody else have to bring to the table? What is everybody else bringing to this potluck of ideas, instead of I am in charge of feeding everybody the ideas?
Yeah, I think you just hit on the point that was crossing my mind listening to you. As somebody who gathers their thoughts and processes their thoughts verbally, I like that verbal ping pong match, which is back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And we're stepping further and further away from the table to handle the speed of this. But it took me a while, longer than I feel like it probably should have in retrospect, to recognize that not everybody has that same style of communication or style of processing their thoughts and communicating with others. And being able to recognize and kind of adapt yourself to the audience that you're talking to, whether that's in a one-on-one or in a larger group setting. And I think to your point, you have to kind of remember it's not about you. It's about the group and making sure that everybody there is able to contribute in the way that's most meaningful for them.
Yeah, I'm definitely unquestionably the slow thinker that needs some time to let all those words roll around in my head and put together what I want to get out. And the leaders that I've worked with that have gotten that have facilitated meetings where there was some space and there was some room for me to speak without having to jump on top of somebody and have something on the tip of my tongue all the time, have been the most productive leaders that I've worked with. And so I try to hit a nice blend in the discussions that I lead, in that I try to make sure that there's that space there, but also that the people that do need to verbal process can have some space to do that as well. And it's an interesting balance to try to run.
Yeah, I think I come at it from the exact opposite point, where I'm trying to slow myself down and allow for that space. And I always appreciate it when I'm having a conversation with somebody and they're just bouncing ideas, and halfway through something, but like, I'm not trying to say exactly what we should do, but I'm just trying to like throw in ideas out there. And I'm like, no, I love this. This is perfect. Let's run with it.
Yeah, there's a compatibility mode that everybody can run in, where I can slow down and leave space. But it's almost like fighting with one hand tied behind my back, because I'm trying to process and I can't process because I'm not working through things verbally. And other people are completely shut out of a conversation if I get my way. And so like you were saying, Nick, trying to balance that is really tricky if you have these sort of styles that are almost incompatible with each other. So what I want to say to people that kind of process stuff verbally is, you're not a bad person for being a bad listener, but it's a really important skill. And the practice of listening will deepen your humility. And I think that's what it kind of comes back to, is I kind of like the idea of digging a little bit into what humility is. But one thing I've learned it's not is self-deprecation. I've always been pretty self-deprecating, and that hasn't made me humble necessarily. I've met a lot of self-deprecating people who are deeply not humble, and they can go together. They're just completely unrelated concepts. That what is a signifier of humility to me is somebody who's really inquisitive and curious about others around them, about the world around them. That to me, somebody who's so clearly interested in learning about what's going on around them before they start interjecting their wisdom, which that one is historically a challenge for me. Here, have some wisdom. Here, have a Werther's of wisdom. And I'm just handing these kids candy they don't want. Oh, I hate Werther's. Nope. Enjoy my wisdom, children. It's genuinely been a challenge for me. And it's only, you know, only recently, literally, I had a meeting with my boss today and said, hey, the thing I would like to work on is help holding me accountable for approaching situations from a curious and inquisitive angle, because it's still a struggle for me even today. So I would imagine that the people that succeed in those environments like crew resource management are the ones that are inquisitive and approach things with a question rather than an answer in their mind.
I mean, I think that's the heart of the training, is getting you to that point. Because if it was only the people that were naturally inquisitive that were pilots, we wouldn't have very many airplanes flying around this country. Because I think it takes some work for everybody to get to that point. I don't know that anybody is born with that amount of ability to set their own ego aside and spend time figuring out what others have on their mind and what others are thinking about and what others care about. It intentionally takes you setting some part of yourself aside to make room for what they're bringing to the table.
We touched briefly on why this doesn't happen everywhere. And I want to dig into that a little more and kind of share a story of a company that I worked for that was basically a cult. And it was like many other startups, in that many startups also are cults. It's the retention plan of companies that can't afford to pay you. So this particular startup I was in had a very dynamic, very well-spoken, very charming leader that was really great at convincing people of something in the moment. And you'd walk away and feel like, gosh, I can't put my finger on it, but that wasn't exactly right. And now I know, like, oh, you've just been manipulated. That's very easy. But at the time you're like, gosh, I made a lot of sense a minute ago. And this whole company kind of ran on that, and everybody wanted it, you know? Everybody wanted it to be true, because you get to abdicate something very stressful when you say, yeah, my feedback isn't being solicited and my input isn't valued, but somebody's at the rudder. Somebody's, you know, minding the store. Somebody knows where we're going. And if I just do what I'm told, we're going to get somewhere really good. And I mean, we have entire systems, hierarchical systems, that work by turning off your decision-making ability and complying with orders. Entire systems operate this way on purpose. And that's a really hard thing to shake when you get into these disciplines that don't seem compatible with that.
I mean, this is where I have to bring up David Marquette's Turn the Ship Around, because that's exactly what he talks about in that book, is the story of him taking a nuclear submarine in the middle of a very hierarchical organization, the U.S. Navy, and taking it from one of the lowest performing ships in the fleet to the highest performing ship in the fleet, essentially by giving the people on board more control and more agency and trusting them to use their training, with a bit of double check there. So the hierarchy wasn't completely gone, but it was a very different mode of operating for the military, and it took a long time for him to get it there, but with fantastic results.
Yeah, I've definitely been in organizations where I've seen this happen with teams, where you give them a lot of control and a lot of autonomy and put the decision-making power in their hands, and they just thrive. And for whatever reason, things shift and some of that autonomy goes away, and the team just shrivels up and becomes a husk of what it was. And you go talk to the people who are involved with it, and they're like, but wait, you want me to give them more control and have like less of an input on what they're working on? No, they're not performing right. I've got to push them in the right direction. It's like, oh, you're so close. At least you recognize something is not right here, but how you're approaching it.
Yeah, I went for that once. And I actually wrote it down in my like notes on what I'm learning about leadership. And I'm like, well, we're doing an experiment right now. So the question is, can you take a team that's underperforming and get them to a place of performance by taking complete control of the team, moving to command and control? They've had total autonomy and no accountability. So we're going to flip that and give them lots of accountability and very little autonomy, and say, hey, you're in charge of delivering these things, but this is exactly what I want. And I will organize all their work for them and chop it up into little bits. And then once we get this engine started and they can start earning some credibility, then we've got a team, and then we can start giving some autonomy back piece by piece. I'll let y'all guess how that worked out.
I was going to ask, how well did that go?
It was not great. Morale was an issue, it turns out.
Huh.
Yeah, people don't like being told exactly what to do and when to do it. And particularly in the field of knowledge work, where what you're asking them to do is probably wrong. Like, the fact is, if you think you know what you want your team to do, you are probably wrong. Because in the gap between what you know as a manager or a product manager or project manager and what somebody in the code knows, that gap is wide enough for wrong answers to slip through. And the person that knows the code is going to know, hey, there's actually a better trade here. And the best case is that you give them room to sort of have these conversations and you facilitate conversations where people can discuss trade-offs and say, hey, I can give you a lot of what you want. But we wound up creating exactly the thing that we all say we hate, which is hucking stuff over the wall by saying, okay, this is the thing. It's already broken down. All you've got to do is close tickets. And people for a little while will love that, by the way. They'll be like, oh, finally some certainty in my life.
Yeah, teams will beg for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've worked for with engineers before who are like, I just keep throwing stuff at me. Like, for whatever reason, right now, I just want to be heads down and get some wins. And I think the longest I've seen that last for is about maybe 4 or 5 months. And then it's like, so I'm looking around now and ready to figure out what's next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's fine if you're like, if let's say you have a really stressful time in your personal life or whatever, I could see that mm-hmm. being very comforting.
Yeah.
But not being able to feel like you have any influence over the impact that you're having, that your job is just, you know, I had somebody on a team I managed once say, you know what, I just feel like I'm just punching the clock and a code monkey all day. And the difference between that person feeling like that and a person feeling like, man, I'm really killing it this week, is just the span of time. Do the same thing that you felt like you killed it this week and kill it for consecutive weeks. And then you're going to go, what is the impact of my work? Because nothing that I've done has gone to production. I'm not hearing any feedback from customers. Like, whoa, I thought you wanted insulation from all of that. And it turns out people don't want that. They want it to be a little harder than that. And the best thing about being a manager is they will complain to you about giving them exactly what they need. They'll be frustrated. They'll be like, oh, things aren't super 100% clear all the time. Like, yes. Isn't it beautiful?
Yep. I think the same thing goes for process. People tend to ask for more process as a defense mechanism. But every time I feel like I've found the sweet spot of process for a team, almost everybody on the team feels like they're slightly underprocessed.
Mm.
But I think that's the sweet spot where you get people to stay engaged, keep their brains on, have input into the system versus just kicking back and doing what it says on the board.
There's a corollary to that that I think leads to that place that to me is like the crux of what it is to be a humble leader. And this sounds so basic that I'm embarrassed to say it, but it's literally the act of saying, I don't know. And not in a way that's like, I've worked with like leaders who abdicate with, I don't know, like, oh, I don't know. I wish somebody, you know, I feel completely powerless, but you have a leader that's like, oh, I don't know. Actually, that sounds like something you could find out the answer to and come back. And that's a really cool experience when it works. That somebody goes, hey, I brought you this thing. And you're like, crap, that's better than the thing I was going to do. And if you're genuinely an inquisitive person, you may have like conversations around process. Like, hey, we don't like the way that we're doing, you know, sprint, sprint, sprint. This is a marathon, not a sprint. And you're like, great. What are we going to do about it? Do you want training? Do we want to throw everything away and start over? Here's what we've got to do. Here are the problems. Here's the challenge that we're facing. How do we want to solve this? And people will often surprise you because they will bail. I would say like more times than not, right then and there, they bail. And they go, oh, no, that's not what I just wanted. I was just venting. And you're like, oh, okay, that's fine. If you're just sort of venting, but things aren't bad enough for you to actually want to take action on it. But if you're serious, there's something here and I would value your input. And maybe future me will push on that even harder and say, no, you just volunteered to help solve this problem. I think that's really a cool way to approach things. I've been in several scenarios like that recently with leadership at a couple places I've worked. And exactly in the spot where you would expect somebody to be like, and here is the plan, you know, here is the rollout plan. They go, okay, and now here's the brainstorming session where you're going to help us figure out how to roll this out. And you're like, wait, what? You don't have a plan? They're like, nope, but we got a lot of smart people. And at first that feels sort of like a cop-out, like, come on, do your jobs. But then you're like, you know what? We actually did come up with something pretty good.
Yeah, I think from the leader's perspective, that's the thing that's so empowering about leading from a place of humility. It's that you don't have to have all the answers. Is that you can give yourself the permission to say, I don't know, let's find out together, versus feeling like you got to come up with the answers yourself. And that's exactly what CRM teaches, is that The captain doesn't need all the answers, and they shouldn't be expected to come up with all the answers in one of these high-stakes, high-stress situations. And the same thing applies to our teams. As the leader, you shouldn't feel pressed to come up with all of the answers. You should be using all of the resources at your disposal. And the resources at your disposal are a lot of really smart team members that you hired because they're good software engineers and because they're bought in and because they want to do good work. So why would you take that agency away by making all the decisions for them?
I'm just thinking back to all the times where I've talked with senior level management about the team at prior workplaces, and they're complaining about the team not feeling ownership. And I'm like, that is not a thing you get to complain about. You did this. This is our fault. Like, ownership is an artifact that grows in the garden if you've tended it properly.
Yeah, it's a thing that can't exist unless you give some control. Because, I mean, that's when that comes up, it's inevitably, we want the team to work harder, but it's coded as we want the team to have higher ownership. Or at least that's been my experience. Every time I've heard that, it's been a coded way to say we wish the team was working harder than they are.
Yeah, we wish they were more bought into the things that we tell them to care about.
Yeah.
Which is like, well, yeah, that's going to be tough with any group of people ever. That's not humble leadership, by the way.
So I think we're all in agreement here, listening to this discussion, that approaching your job as a leader in an organization, regardless of that role, whether it's a VP or CTO or a senior developer on a team, that approaching with a little bit more humility and openness is a good thing. We've been in a very theoretical space talking about why that's good and how that works and why people should be approaching the world that way. What's something practical that me as that senior developer or leader in an organization could ask myself at the start of the week and say, okay, I want to monitor this, and then get to the end of the week and have that as something to reflect on and say, okay, this is the progress that I made in this front, and here's the outcome of that, or where I anticipate that outcome being. It might be that it could be weeks or months before you see the fruit of that, but what's something practical that somebody could put into effect starting today listening to this podcast?
So I have actually heard people use this is actually more for developers coming into an organization, but use the idea of a question quota, that there's X number of questions that I want you to ask this week. If you're not asking enough questions, it tells me that you're going pretty far based on trying to play to your strengths already that you already have and not, you know, finding out more. That might be a little draconian, but I've seen it done sort of voluntarily. This is a friend of mine who wanted to make sure that they were asking enough questions on their way into a place. So this is literally a conversation I've had today where I've asked for help being held accountable for coming into conversations with this mindset. And so if I were to like measure it as like an OKR or something like that, I would try to mentally tally how many conversations I went into where I had feedback for somebody that I was able to pivot into a question asking scenario, where I dug for information and context rather than just dropping feedback in. Because I'm pretty good at going in and saying, okay, hey, I've got some feedback for you. That was great. Hey, I've got some tough feedback for you. Do you have a minute? And that wasn't so great. And here's what I would hope to see different. That's actually really hard. And I felt like I did it. I can do the hard thing now. But the next, you know, the galaxy brain version of this is being able to go into that scenario and have the person come to their own realization about it by asking questions and say, you know, hey, what was your impression of how it was received? If you had anything to do differently to do it over, what would you do differently? Like, what were you hoping to accomplish? Did you get everything that you wanted out of it? If you didn't, what would you have hoped for? And a lot of times, like, I'm not extremely well practiced at this technique, but that feels like if you're genuine and you come across as authentic and you're not just, you know, like smearing the Socratic method on top of feedback that you wish to give somebody, if you're genuinely interested in helping somebody discover something for themselves, even if it's not an assumption you already had, I think that will come across. And I think humility is kind of magic, because when it's real, you know it.
Yeah.
It's just real. Like, Captain Haynes was a humble person. It just proves out over time.
Yeah. I've definitely witnessed developers and leaders in organizations who have that genuineness, and there's no way to fake that. It's just, they're like genuinely humble, curious people, and everyone who interacts with them loves them because that comes through in the way they interact with the world.
I think another practical thing that's sort of the flip side of that is it's helpful to monitor how often you have a defensive reaction to something, because that's often a sign that you're not operating from a place of humility, that you're operating from a place where you feel like you do need to be the authority and the expert. So if you go into a conversation and you find yourself, say, faking an answer versus saying, I don't know, but I'll find out, or if you find yourself feeling threatened by the actions of somebody that you should be working with. I mean, as an engineering manager, maybe it's a product manager you work with, project manager, maybe it's your boss. But if they're doing something helpful and you find yourself feeling threatened rather than open to that help, I think those are both signs that you may need to check what's going on in your head and where you're coming from that's making you feel that way.
Wow, that's really a profound concept, because I think most of the time what we talk about is a lack of humility is actually somebody sort of defending a place where they feel vulnerable that they don't want to like let out. I know that's true for me, like when I have that reaction, and having the reaction and processing it are not the same thing. Having the reaction is like perfectly natural. What I'm trying to get to is like shortening the loop from having the reaction to being able to like bring my adult self back into that. Be like, hang on. Yeah, that's not my favorite feeling. Seems like there's a part of me that is defensive about this. And what I do, literally what I do now when I receive feedback that causes me to like have a little mini panic in that moment, is I will say, hey, I actually need a minute to process this feedback. Thank you for giving me that. Can you give me a little bit to process that and think about it? And invariably, once I like am able to pull myself together and bring my adult back into the situation, I will understand what was true about what they said. A humble approach to taking feedback. I don't know if we've talked about this already or not. I heard this on a podcast called Reboot that I love dearly. And Jerry, the guy that runs the podcast, talks about processing this stuff and not just thinking about it in terms of their perspective of like, oh, why this might be true from their perspective, but like why it's true generally. What about what this person said, unless it was in bad faith, what about what this person said is true about me? And being able to like just directly look at parts of yourself that aren't your favorite and kind of recognize like, hey, you know what? Not all the parts of myself are my favorite part of myself. That's probably one of the most challenging things. And I'm shocked at how often it comes up at work and how much some part of myself that's not my favorite part of myself gets revealed in ways that I find embarrassing at work. Growing that skill of being able to sort of shake hands with that, I think it comes from a place of being more interested in someone else, someone else's result, someone else's perspective, someone else's needs than protecting something about me and being something to somebody. And coming back to like why we have this sort of like captain illusion, like the opposite of humility is needing to be this person that we think we're supposed to be. And humility is going, hey, that person, that perfect captain doesn't exist. We're just a team here and we're figuring this out. And some of my favorite leaders are people who approach leadership from that angle, that, hey, we're figuring this thing out together. And it feels heretical because they're supposed to have all the answers. But I'm so grateful for the ones that don't like put that front of BS up and act like they've got all the answers. I've worked for those people and it's horrible after a while. So yeah, to me, the crux of what humble leadership is the welcoming of the idea that we don't all have it figured out and that we are in the process of figuring it out.
Yeah, I think the analogy from the cockpit is the 25-year captain and the 3-day first officer walking into the cockpit together and getting into some type of accident scenario, and the 3-day first officer being so fresh out of training, catching something that the captain's just overlooked. And the same thing happens on our teams every week. We have an early career developer that walks in with still beginner's mind and asks a question that everybody else in the team would consider obvious, but turns out to be the thing that unlocks the performance of that team because it makes them consider something that they've just been living with.
Mm-hmm. Boy, these tests sure take a long time to run. What if we made them faster? And everybody goes, boo, wait. Actually, what if we did?
And the thing is, as a manager of a team or as a senior developer on a team, it is so easy to shut down that inquisitiveness and to be defensive about, this is the thing that I've built and it's my perfect shiny team. Who are you to ask questions? It's so easy to let yourself do that. And it takes a lot of humility not to.
The way that I've seen that manifest on a lot of teams is, oh, you should have seen it before. Like somebody new comes in and is like, wow, this could be better. And you go, well, you should have seen it before. Like welcoming the perspective of somebody saying, you know, hey, you may not know, but that actually took a lot of effort just to get to this point. That's great context. But also that person has a valuable perspective. Hey, this could be better. And being open to ways things could be better is like, that's a pretty humble approach.
So I think the thing about sort of processing the death of Captain Haynes today is realizing for me how much of a personal hero he had become to me. Because I don't think I really knew that until today, until I saw the news this morning. And it caught me off guard, and it was a bit of a gut punch. And the reason it was such a gut punch to me is that there are so many things about the way that he behaved in that accident sequence that I want to see in myself on a day-in, day-out basis. They're things that I strive for on an everyday basis, to have that humility to lead in such a way that I don't expect myself to have all the answers. And that's really the challenge, right? Because we're the ones that expect ourselves to have all the answers. And it's getting out of that headspace and allowing others to come in and have input that's so important. The most interesting thing about that accident sequence to me is there is a United test pilot that Captain Haynes invited up to the cockpit. And he's the one that ends up on the throttles because it's between the captain and the first officer. And it's just more convenient for the guy in the jump seat to run the throttles. And he ends up being the one that is actually flying the plane. And they realize this a long time before they get to the Sioux City airport. But instead of pulling him off the controls and manning the controls himself, Captain Haynes says, no, you stay on the controls because you've got the rhythm down. So he gives off the one piece of input that he has into his plane, because he's not the one that is best equipped to be running those throttles at that point. He's not the one that has the information in his head. And that's ultimately where I want to be as a leader. I want to be the one that gives away the controls to the people that are really in position to make the best decisions. That, to me, is the real legacy of Captain Haynes.
Thanks, Nick, for bringing us this topic. And I'm sorry that you lost your hero. I know that feeling. And I love that the thing that made you feel close to this person was the depth of his humility as a leader. That says a lot about you, in my opinion, that this is a person that you didn't know personally, but you feel like you do. I certainly think that's something we're striving toward. And I think it's cool that as we get older, we get to pick heroes that live lives that we actually, you know, we're not going to land a plane with and save a bunch of people's lives, but we get to live our lives in a way that touches people in that way if we want to. So I think that's as good a place as any to wrap up. For everybody listening, thank you for joining us. You can get a hold of us at Managing Up Show on Twitter if you have topic ideas or suggestions. I'm Tim Viking on Twitter.
I am In Means on Twitter.
And I am T. Swice, good most everywhere.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you again next time.